Muay Thai kickboxing. If you want to make a major change in your life, if you want to lose weight, get in shape, become the badass that you should be, then reach out to us and we'll help you on your mission. And I'm here with my co-host, as always, Dan Robin. How you doing, Dan?
Good. How you doing, John?
Awesome. We have a really exciting guest today.
Yeah, it's a good one.
So the way you do it is you're supposed to like read out his accolades and his biography and everything. Then you say his name last.
Did you prepare that, though?
I completely unprepared. Yeah, as usual. Well, I will say this. He is a professional MMA fighter, also a coach, a trainer of mixed martial arts, excellent martial artist, and he has one unique accomplishment. He is the very first Irishman to fight in the UFC. That's something that they can never take away from him. Unless some Irishman invents time travel, goes back in time and gets in really good shape and enters the UFC earlier, he's always going to have that.
Yeah, that's permanent.
That's permanent. And he's Mr. Tom Egan. How you doing, Tom?
Good, guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure for sure, man.
So as you're talking about going back in time, I was just watching Infinity War, the Avengers Infinity War last night again, for like the 17th time. And the big one is the Time Stone. So, I've got that replica of that Infinity Gauntlet that Thanos has, so I've got all the stones, so I'm good.
So if somebody goes back in time, you're just going to jump back a few years ahead of them.
You're even prepared for that.
Do you guys watch those movies, any of those Marvel movies?
100%.
It's funny, did you see the new Deadpool?
That's the movie? One. That's the literally the one I haven't seen yet.
Oh my god, have you seen it, John?
No,
gotta watch it.
Better than the first one.
Yes, but I won't even say what I was gonna say because you know, talking about time travel and stuff. But whatever. Anyways,
what we would like to hear is, and we ask many of our guests, sort of what their origin story is. Like, when did they enter martial arts? Were you bullied as a kid? Can you tell us about your childhood and when the idea first entered your mind? I want to learn some martial art.
I kind of had like a whole host of reasons why I got into martial arts. And also, you know, all the typical ones, you know, I was fascinated by all the martial arts movies. I remember one big movie that kind of really got me into the thought of doing martial arts was Mortal Kombat.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that cheesy ass 90s movie?
Yeah.
Great movie. I just watched it again the other day. It was great. So watching that, like watching all these amazing, unique characters, fighters, different martial artists from, you know, various different backgrounds all being brought together for this like tournament. I mean, obviously a slight ripoff of Enter the Dragon, Bruce Lee's
right.
movie, right? But I'm saying in a cool way, everyone's got a different character, different set of skills and everything. And so when I saw that, I was like, wow, all these guys have all their own unique things. They're all badasses. I'm like, each guy has their own individual thing that makes them like a badass, and that kind of stood out to me because really if you look at the real world of martial arts or mixed martial arts or fighting or boxing, typically it is that kind of way, right? Everyone's got a different background, different place, different country, culture, whatever. And they've got their own thing that makes them unique, and then they get to the top or they fight in you know, in these big stages. So that was obviously one.
They all have their own strength and their own philosophy almost to fight.
Yeah.
Was there a character from that movie that you identified more strongly with than another?
You know what? My favorite character was actually Sub-Zero. And I think because he didn't say anything. He didn't say anything, but he had like this very stoic persona. And he was like, I don't know what. Scorpion was almost like, he's very brash. He's like, get over here. You know, he says that. But Scorpion, Sub-Zero doesn't say a word. He just, like a fighter, he just goes in, gets it done.
It's all business.
And I think I identified with him the most. I understand you got to, you know, nowadays, obviously, we see everyone's trash talking, right? Because it's how you get out there.
Conor McGregor just made it the obvious path for professional fighters to take. Yeah.
Well, he wasn't the first to do it. It's amazing because he copied Floyd Mayweather. I mean, Ali was the first to do it. He was not the first, but...
You know where Ali got his instruction from?
Who?
Is Gorgeous George. There was a famous wrestler in the 50s.
Oh, wow.
He wore platinum hair, and he had a very effeminate style and personality. He would come out with a butler. They would throw rose petals in front of him.
Right. So it's all entertainment, right?
Right.
So
but Gorgeous George also learned that everyone hating me helps me.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I think he was the one that learned, like, it would be like sort of the working class wrestling crowds in like the Midwest, and he'd come out like spraying them with perfume and being like really effeminate.
He would drive the crowd
and
wild.
And they'd want to see him get his ass
full of hate.
18,000 people would want him to die, and then he would somehow cheat and win, and the place would just go crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that what Floyd Mayweather used to say? He used to be like, hate me or love me, you want to watch me no matter what. Yeah. And then Conor adopted that too, if you think about it. Mm. You know, I think Conor's always had more love than hate when it comes to fans, you know?
I definitely think so.
He just falls underneath that kind of bad guy category naturally, the way his persona rolls off. But going back to what I was saying, Mortal Kombat, I liked Sub-Zero. It didn't say a word, came out and did business, you know? So Mortal Kombat being one of the things that I remember as a kid saying, wow, this is really unique and cool, watching all these guys come together. That kind of got me into want to watch more martial arts movies.
Mm.
And eventually my mother was sick of seeing me, you know, punching and kicking things as a 12-year-old. And she sent me to a martial arts academy, which wasn't far from where we were living. It was called Bushido Martial Arts, which was run by my original martial arts instructor, Roy Baker, who I still to this day would say he's got the most influence on me as far as my attitude towards martial arts and training, you know, especially when it comes to coaching.
And what's the biggest distinction that Roy Baker had for you? How did he do that other people might not be doing or something like that, you know?
Well, number one, when it came to sport karate, which is what he specialized in, which is very, very big. Like, if you get into the sport karate world, it's huge.
Mm.
It's like, it's crazy.
Right. And just to be clear, was this before there was even MMA gyms? You know, like, did you even have the option of going to...
Yeah, you're 12. What year was it when you were
12, 13 years of age. So, I mean, it would have been 2001.
The UFC's going strong at
that
point.
Well, yeah. It was just bought over by the Zuffa guys redoing it. Well, not just bought over. They bought it in the late 90s, right? And then they started redoing it. To answer your question, what is it that he did? So in that world of sport karate, you know, he'd been the best guy. Like, he, in terms of international competition... not at this particular time, but during his time, he was definitely the top guy, you know? And he just had a really good competitive attitude. He had a very... He still to this day does have a good competitive attitude. He's like the president of WACO, the World Association, or World Kickboxing Organization, or something like that. And he does a lot of work with them and stuff. And now with the rise of guys like Wonder Boy and guys like McGregor and... You know, all these guys with that kind of sport karate style that they're bringing into MMA. It's the sport karate world is now... And you've got that guy, what's his name there? Michael Venom Page. All these guys.
He's amazing.
Amazing.
Wow.
And that's a sport karate guy. He's a sport karate guy. So the sport karate world is starting to catch the attention of the mixed martial arts world now. Because they're realizing it's not about just being stiff and strong and powerful. It's... But being elusive and quick and
fast.
That's
what's so great about mixed martial arts, isn't it? The constant evolution. And you're right. There was a point in time where I think a lot of MMA fans had no appreciation for sport karate, I'm sure. They thought that wouldn't work in the cage.
Without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, me included.
Yeah.
I went from sport karate into mixed martial arts. And it's funny, my dad didn't really have any martial arts experience besides he did a couple months. My mother's the one... I was about to get to my next reason why I got into it. My mother, like I said, was tired of seeing me kicking and punching things. So she brought me to the school, which is run by Roy Baker. But my mother herself, she had done Shotokan karate for years in her younger days. She was a black belt in Shotokan. She got to her black belt level. She didn't actually, it's funny, she actually missed the graduation to get her black belt. She almost got like an honorary black belt. But she'd done all the time and competing and everything like that, and I believe her instructor had handed it to her later on down the line because she, you know, put all the work in. And then, of course, when she met my dad, had me, she got away from it. But she had been the one in the family who had been doing martial arts for years, competing. I don't know if you ever watched Shotokan or Kyokushin competition. They basically just have the wrapped hands.
Right.
It's full contact body, but kicking to the head. And these guys are doing...
Who was in on that rule meeting where they're like, we don't want people to get hurt. No punching to the face, but you could do a spinning wheel kick to the head.
Right, yeah. Insane. Maybe they figured it's less likely or something. I don't know.
Well, I think it probably forces you to be more effective kicking, and they probably want to emphasize that part of the art,
That's obviously what karate is known for.
It stops boxers from coming in and, you know, winning a tournament and knocking someone
out.
You could see the most devastating knockouts in that sport.
It's
amazing,
insane.
Right?
So anyway, she competed in that. So she had obviously a lot of competition and that stuff. And then my dad had, when they met, he did, I'd say a few months to maybe a year of this stuff. My father's very athletic. He was always athletic in general. He played rugby, soccer, all those sports, you know, and he got to a good level in them, and he played a collegiate level in rugby and stuff like that. So he'd always been competitive. So he was able to throw down, you know, when he kind of got into it. But the funniest thing is, you know, obviously Roy Baker being my martial arts coach, but of everybody, realistically, when I transitioned into mixed martial arts, it was always my dad who turned around to me and said, Tom, you don't need to be taking on this stiff style that you think you need. You need to be, keep your quick, fast elusiveness that you know, because he knew I was obsessed with Bruce Lee. He goes, why is it that you're doing MMA and you're becoming like a stiff Thai boxer type guy, and yet your guy Bruce Lee, who you love, you're not moving like that, you know.
Emulating that.
And I was like, Dad, you don't know what you're talking about, because obviously my, you know, at that time I was looking at Shogun and Vandalay, all these stiff guys. My dad was always give me the right advice, and of course now I'm able to turn around and be like, Dad, you know what, you're 100% right about everything. My dad, in like 2005, I remember him telling me, he's like, Tom, when you get into MMA, he's like, I don't understand why guys don't just do a straight front kick to the mouth. He goes, I don't get it. All these guys are doing all these kicks around, it's being blocked. And then, of course, years later, you have like Machida.
But at the time, were you like, oh, you don't get it. That doesn't work.
I was like, you don't get it. He was,
because I think people might forget that for a while it was like, karate's wrong. You know, it was like, karate's not going to work.
Front kick will get you killed.
Yeah.
And and they'll grab it or something. My dad was like, no, just real quick. Boom. My dad used to say, you don't even need to put a lot of weight in it. Just flick it right at the mouth. And he never, no competitive martial arts experience. And I always disregarded.
But he wasn't overly influenced by the culture. So he could just use his common sense to say, why wouldn't you do that? Yeah.
And the other thing too is, because he was good at a lot of different sports, my dad has a natural ability to kind of understand another sport, considering that a lot of sports have parallel principles. Like all the principles are very similar. If you think about it.
He at least knew enough to ask the question, like, why aren't they doing that?
Exactly.
Like, maybe I'm missing something, but it seems like it's available. Who's the highest profile guy? Was it Anderson Silva first did it?
No, it's Lyoto Machida. Was the one that
Vitor Belfort got knocked out by Anderson Silva with that kick.
All right.
Well, that's with the kick.
Then Machida did the jumping one to Randy Couture.
That's right.
But Machida was the one that was like, wait, karate works.
Yes.
And then for a while, people forget that Machida was like, well, now he can't be beat. Like, you know, it was like no one can beat his
karate
style.
When he beat Rashad Evans, everyone was like, that's it. It's Machida.
They'd say the Machida era.
That seems to constantly happen. Some guy comes in with a new approach and is very effective, and then we quickly pronounce them
all the
invincible,
way back.
And then they promptly lose. You know,
Well, Royce was invincible, and then Mark Coleman was invincible, and then, you know, there was always someone that was like, well, now look at this wrestler, no one can beat him. Dan Severn was invincible, you know. And
I think it's funny. I always talk about George St. Pierre because he wasn't nowhere near the best striker. If you think about it, when it comes to striking, very kind of like raw, you know.
BJ Penn would punch him up with just jabs, right?
Yeah. Right. Wrestling, obviously, that was his favorable part. He's strong and athletic. And then jiu-jitsu, even his jiu-jitsu wasn't all that. Like, I have friends of mine who've rolled, and they said, I was rolling with George St. Pierre, and it was like, I wasn't really blown away. But he was just smart. The reason why he was able to stay on top for so long is because he could adapt so well, you know. He was able to be like, I'll get you here. Or you're good here, I'll get you here, and maybe a little bit there. And, you know, he could break it down really well. Just to go back to what I was talking about, Mortal Kombat, my mom was tired of seeing me beating up everything. So she wanted to send me to a karate school where I met Roy Baker and started competing there. But previous to all of this, throughout my youth, yes, I was always the younger kid in my area. And where we lived, the part of Dublin I grew up, was an area called Lucan. It's on the Kildare border. At that time, when I was growing up, there was a lot of people from the inner city of Dublin moving out to these newer areas. Economy was booming in the late 90s, early 2000s. All these people were moving out. So in these newer housing estates, you had all these, like, some people who started to make money, who were in the inner city parts, coming out. And these kids that were coming out into these areas where I was growing up, where I started to grow up, they were older than me, but they were a little bit more gritty and streety type kids, because they've been from the inner city, you know? So I'm this little kid growing up in this nice part of Dublin. They're coming from the city. I'm the younger kid. I naturally, as I fell in, tried to make friends with, you know, or groups of friends with these people. I got, you know, bullied around a little bit, especially because them coming from those parts of the city, It'd be the equivalent of, let's say, all the old school Southie people moving out to Braintree before Braintree's Braintree, or moving out to nice old Canton there. I was like growing up in Canton, and all these Southie people were moving out, and I'm the young kid, and you got all these guys like, hey, F you, you know, you know.
But they're looking at you like a lamb. Yeah.
So basically, I got bullied, you know, as a kid, verbally, physically, the whole lot. Right. Some days, like I got so frustrated, you know. So I kind of was like,
you're waiting for a savior, somebody to come in, and crack some skulls.
Yeah, I wanted somebody to come in and just kick ass for me. Because there'd be days where I'd be out with my younger brother and maybe a friend, and we'd be just happy playing soccer, and these assholes would come along. They'd come along and they'd just cause trouble, and just like we'd have to just leave. And it was just like, come on, man, we'd have to leave. And sometimes we'd be lucky to leave without catching a beating. You know?
Right.
So
it's just, your first thought wasn't, I'm going to learn to beat these guys up. You at first were just like, I hope someone else does it.
Yeah, I just want these guys to get their ass kicked.
Well, they're bigger and older and so forth. Yeah. You know, we were talking about this last week, Dan and I, about how in Boston, things are different than they are now. Like when I grew up, there was danger in every other corner. Mm. So like you go three blocks and there's guys who are 2 to 4 years older than me, and they're basically going to take whatever pocket change I have, slap me around a little bit, and there's nothing you could do about it.
We were saying how back in those days it was like accepted, like it was like if you run into older kids, it's bad for you. Like it's just bad. Yeah. Like if you're walking down the street and there's older kids, that's bad situation. Yeah.
Nobody really cares. There's no justice.
And the parents would be like, well, that's kid stuff. Like,
Well, one time it got to a really bad point. I remember my dad got really frustrated. And one day, like, we were all playing soccer. Again, I go back to my dad because my dad's a very influential person in my life, particularly in my old, now that I'm older, because now I see all the shit that he had to go through at my age, you know? Plus, obviously, seeing all of his advice that he gave me. But one day I was out, I'll never forget it, playing soccer. And the one group of kids that were always picking on me, my dad came out and he was just like, cut the shit. And he was like, this is it. You get over here. And then the kid's dad came out, who was a bit of a hard ass. And he was kind of involved in martial arts, this guy too, you know, from the inner city, tattoos on him, whatever. And he came out. My dad at this point wasn't playing much sports, was working on, he was a tech guy. He got involved in computers and the internet right when it was taken off. He runs his own company, a software company right now, but he was getting into it at the time. So he's just a techie office guy, but he was sick of all this shit. This guy comes out and he's like, hey, what are you doing to the kids? And my dad just gets right in his face. He goes, your kids, I've had enough of it. Get them out of here. We're staying here. And the guy was like to my dad, I'll hit you. And my dad was like, go on, hit me. See what happens. Got right in his face. He's like, go on, hit me. The guy just grabbed his kid and walked right in. And at that point, I was like, my dad did it. My dad came through. And everybody in the whole street was watching. So I was waiting on some other kid to come and do it. It was actually my dad that did it. But the funny thing is, like, over time, that was something that resonated with me later on. And I appreciated it at the time. Like, obviously, there was other points where I wish I was able to go back and see that, you know, because naturally when you're growing up, you go through it with your parents here and there, you know what I mean? But my dad was the one that came to, he was just like, all right, enough of this crap. I can see my son, he's going through a lot. He can't really get back at it with these kids. Boom. So after that, it was kind of like right after that point that I was saying, I shouldn't have to have my dad come out now anymore. He's like, I was like, I need to start getting my shit together. So couple that, maybe that's why I started taking an interest in martial arts, which led to my mother sending me to the school. Right. You know what I'm saying? So that's kind of like how it went down. Being bullied, dad stands up for me. I realize, okay, I need to do this myself now. Because you know what it was about the Mortal Kombat movie that I watched? All those guys were individuals. They had nobody looking after them.
They just all show up themselves.
Yeah. But I'm saying, like, they didn't need... coach is somebody who coached it, but they were all just their own individual.
They're one man army.
They're one man, and they didn't need anybody to help them. So I think... Obviously, I love that my dad came and helped me, but after it happened, I think it was me saying to myself, right, somebody did come and help me, but now I should be doing this by myself.
Tom, I think that's so important. People naturally want a savior to come. They think, I want somebody to save me, and nobody's coming to save you. And once you learn that lesson, and you learned it at a young age, I think it's so effective, so empowering to realize, I have to save myself. Dan, did your dad ever face down any bullies?
One time.
Your dad did?
One time. But just because he was much older and bigger than me. And it got physical. He was slapping me in the face and slapped me around right outside my house. So I came in, I think I was crying, or I don't exactly remember. I just know I got, and then he was like, who did it? And it was a kid who was, you know, I'm up to here on him. So it was sort of like, well, that's unfair. Kid,
2 feet taller than you were.
Yeah. So that's unfair. So that's the one time he came out and he was just yelling at the kid. And, you know,
basically
just,
same situation with me. But I think that's what led me to having the interest in martial arts, that individualism that I need to have my own back, which has stood by me because I wouldn't have been able to move over here from Ireland if I didn't have that type of mindset that the martial arts had given me, that individual. You got it. I mean, I know it's a team effort, team sport, but at the end of the day, you get in there by yourself. You know, coaches can't pull your strings. So when you do compete, you do whatever, you're in there. So it definitely stands by when you go to other places, all of a sudden the dark alleyway doesn't look so dangerous anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can cut through this part of town now because I'm confident.
Now, how long did you train with Roy Baker?
So Roy Baker, I trained with Roy from the age of around 12. I was on and off going to karate like between 12 and 13. And then 13, 14 is when I really picked it up. And then I did that until I was about 17, 18. So I was with Roy, training with him and all those guys pretty much through those important transitions from a young boy into like a grown teenager, becoming a man type stages, you know?
Yeah.
And I just saw a lot of how I like to do things now as a coach in MMA is I related to what I learned from him, how he coached very, you know, organized, like to be structured.
Was
and straight
there
up.
Some other part of like his philosophy that resonated with you and stayed with you, other than like he was an excellent competitor, and it sounds like he was a very professional, prepared guy, and get all his students and competitors prepared properly. How did he look at the whole fighting and why you're fighting and why you're competing, or is there anything there?
I think a lot of that particular stuff that you're asking me, like philosophy, mindset stuff, I got that from maybe through my own research, meeting other people. With Roy, it was more so I learned the art of karate, the competitiveness, you know, just through doing it, watching it, listening to him, watching him. He was just a great person that I've always been able to watch and learn from. There was no necessarily philosophies that stand out in my mind that I got from him versus just watching him and learning from him, being around him and how he conducted his school, how he ran everything, how he trained his guys, how he trained us, trained me.
Now, let me ask you this. So you started at 12 and you're training with him to like 17, 18, something like that. And so you're getting proficient at karate. Did you feel your esteem in your social group was rising because like Tom's getting really good at karate? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or do girls start having interest in you? The guys start respecting you? All of that stuff, you know?
Honestly, I was always the worst with girls because my problem always was I had the same personality basically as I do now. I was very outspoken, outgoing. I'd say things quite straight front and bluntly. Like I never, I didn't go through the typical kid. Like I was just like, what if everybody just beating around? Just say how it is. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't understand this, so I did terrible with girls. Because girls,
so you didn't play the game. You
girls always thought. Girls always, yeah. I would be like, "Hey, you want to go out? Like, or you want to go do this, that, and the other?" And girls would be always like, "You're supposed to text me 5 times. I'm supposed to write back, maybe." Like, I was like, just boom, you know. So I think I failed terribly as girls. Yeah, certainly. Like later on in my teenage years, I've been competing and all this kind of stuff, and I started to see MMA. I saw you guys had Spike over here. We had We had a channel back home. Oh my God, I forget the name of this channel. It was basically our equivalent to Spike. They would show all that crazy stuff like that. Like, you know, Joe Rogan's Fear Factor, UFC.
Right. Yeah, like masculine stuff.
Like, right? Yeah, all that kind of crazy stuff. Like the late night stuff would be like
Johnny Knoxville and all that nuttiness. Yeah.
Or even those shows where like they go around and they find like all sexual fetishes in different cities in Europe. These crazy shows, right? Yeah. But they had the late night, they'd show some UFC on there. And I remember a couple of times McGregor stayed over at my, because we went to high school together, McGregor and I did. So a couple of times he had stayed over at my place when we were trying to work out together. We'd watch this stuff, or I'd call him and be like, yeah, or I'd tell him in school, yeah, this time tonight, they're showing this UFC stuff. Make sure you watch it. And, you know, we'd end up watching. So, yeah, late in my teens, I started watching all that stuff. So I'd started to been trying to maybe transition into, I was trying to find somewhere I could learn this jiu-jitsu stuff because I saw Royce Gracie do it. And so at this point, like, I'm starting to start, you know, my mind's starting to drift away from the sport karate stuff. Initially, the sport itself wasn't really, people didn't like it. Boxers thought it was awful.
Thought MMA, you mean?
Yeah, MMA. Yeah. They thought it was brutal. Like, even my own instructor.
Cockfighting with humans or something.
Yeah, even my own instructor, Roy, at the time, he didn't have the best opinion about me getting involved.
I think part of it, too, was when the UFC first started, Tom, the premise was Brazilian jiu-jitsu is superior to everything else. You know, that's what the UFC was supposed to prove. Mm. So that's kind of obnoxious. You know what I mean? If you're a martial artist like Roy Baker and somebody else is coming along and saying, you're doing it all wrong, we're better than you.
Yeah.
That's not really respectful.
But right. I also way, think right? when you had this martial arts aspect of like meditation and bowing, and then like those early UFCs, they had the headbutts and the groin strikes. So it was sort of like not, you know what I mean? It was sort of like Mark Coleman headbutting someone 50 right. times into a bloody pulp, or what's his name with Joe San, like hitting him in the crotch 10 times until he taps out. And like, it doesn't really seem
dignified.
It seems like this is barbaric, right? Like we're meditating and that guy's headbutting him into a pulp. You
it's
know?
Amazing, John. I never thought about it like that. Yeah, here comes a group of people saying that what you're doing is wrong. See, the way I looked at it was basically when I felt that message or saw that message, whatever it be, subconsciously I read into it, but I was just seeing what was going on in front of my eyes. Right. I wasn't like, all right, I didn't take offense to it. I was like,
yeah,
I got to learn that.
Yeah.
I was like, that's what I got to do. And ultimately, I think I've always, since those days where I was being bullied, and then after my dad had saved my ass that day, even though there was a couple of other instances after that where he wasn't around, I still kind of got bullied, you know. But since then, I've always been looking to prove something to myself, right? And I've always been looking for it. And I did the sport karate and all this kind of stuff. But when this UFC stuff came out and I found out that there was a way for me to actually do it, I was like, if I can do that and I can be somewhat successful at it, no one can ever doubt me, and I have proven 1,000% to myself that I can survive and do something extremely stressful and like crazy and like come out okay. And I was like, if I could do that, I know I will have satisfied myself. So essentially what I've done, or things that have happened since I've gotten involved in mixed martial arts, you know, I've essentially accomplished above and beyond what I set out to do. All I set out to do with mixed martial arts was compete, show myself that I can actually get into this crazy thing, do it a couple of times, be somewhat good at it, and then I'll never need to do anything else for the rest of my life, because I'd have proven to me and the younger me who was so stuck and no one could help him, you know, who I felt lost, I would just be able to say, right, boom, and no one would be able to take that away from me, right? Like you said about the first Irish guy thing, no one can take that away from me. No one would be able to take away that I did that. So that's initially what I got in it to do.
That is so cool. I mean, mindset is important and dreaming is important, but ultimately it's the doing, like the actual something happening in the real world. And you change from that, the young Tom. You know, you told me a story. You know, Tom and I went to Tokyo last year and cornered Tyler King. Yeah. And we had an amazing experience in Japan. Tom loves Japan, by the way. He is just built for it.
I was there last month.
Where?
Tokyo.
Yeah.
Tokyo?
Yeah, and then I went out. I climbed Mount Fuji, too. But,
come on.
Yeah.
You're not just... No. You're serious? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, last month. Yeah.
I thought he was saying, like, yeah, I went to Tokyo, and I also, like, you know, I fought a dragon. Yeah. You know? I thought you were... But you actually climbed Mount Fuji.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
It's not like Mount Everest. It's more like...
Man, I just love Japan. I've always loved Japan. So that was one thing. Another thing, when I started to get into martial arts as a young kid, it just so happened that one of my best friends that I grew up with at that time, like from 12 to like 14 or 15, was from China. So I'd come home from school and I'd go straight out to his house. His mom wouldn't be home, but his uncle would be home cooking a huge pot of noodles. And we'd just be sitting there eating noodles, watching Dragon Ball Z. You know, and that's like ultimate martial arts stuff, Dragon Ball Z, you know, fire blast, fighting.
I know, I love how your inspiration, like other people are like fighters, like even Bruce Lee, but yours are like the Mortal Kombat guys. Like,
yeah, it's
like
always doing like cartoon characters.
Like lightning blasts and like things you could never.
Well, it kind of makes sense in a way because they're bigger than life, you know what I mean? Yeah. So you have to use your imagination when you want something different in your life anyway. So if you're a young person and you don't feel empowered, you can use a lot of imagination to get there anywhere. So we might as well use these kind of cartoon characters.
You're absolutely right. Honest to God, I swear to God, there's been times where I've been motivated more by these cartoons than like anything real.
I think so. You know, I'm a lot older than you, but for me, it was always superheroes, whether it's Spider-Man or Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And character is real in a sense. It's something to really aspire to.
Right.
So it's much more powerful than even Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Because he's almost a superhero, but he's a real person, you know?
It's amazing you talked about how the martial arts world was stripped from all its traditions and stuff, which is essentially what Bruce Lee was all about. You know, his whole concept was like, if you follow tradition over and over again, you won't get anywhere. You need to, he's like, not to necessarily do away with it, embrace it, but you got to power through that and find something else. It's amazing because if you read his book, Tao of Jeet Kune Do, the early UFC days are exactly why he imagined how real competitive fighting should be. And it's great that the UFC gave him his shine and put him in the UFC games and did all the cool t-shirts and stuff because he essentially was the first mixed martial artist.
Right.
Yeah. Because there's at least one of his movies where he has MMA gloves on, he's fighting a guy in the arm bars.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was in the 70s.
Was it Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? Will Chamberlain? No.
It was like just random Asian dude he fought. And it was the beginning of Enter the Dragon.
But yeah, to your point, I think some people might even not even know how it used to be like, our style is the best pre-UFC. And it was like, our style is the best. And it was like derogatory towards the other styles, right?
And
Bruce Lee was the first one to be like, let's learn all of it. Like learn what works and learn what's best.
I think, like Tom was talking about tradition, I think what happens in martial arts is you have this tradition, which is just like a plow, just scooping everything forward into the future. Unfortunately, it's taking anything that's superfluous and unnecessary and it's collecting it and bringing it forward. And then a guy like Bruce Lee is like, yeah, some of this stuff is not helping. It's hurting us. So we have to sort of, you know, weed the garden here a little bit and prune this stuff.
The great thing about the competitive platform, which is mixed martial arts, is that it allows you to bring whatever you want in there and see if it works.
Right.
Who'd have thought a spinning elbow would work? Who'd have thought that a guy like John Jones, late into the fourth round, he's in the deep waters with Gustafsson. You could see him constantly trying to find a way. Gustafsson's getting his hands on him. I mean, yeah, Gustafsson landed more punches. I watched that fight so many times.
Mm.
Gustafsson was ahead on punches, but Jones was ahead on all strikes. Punch, kicks, elbows, knees. He was ahead on all strikes. That's the reason why he won that decision. End of the fourth round, he's digging deep. One of the best examples of true mixed martial arts. He fakes for a single leg, gets Gustafsson to level change, spinning elbow, hits him right in the forehead.
Mm.
And then Gustafsson is surviving that last minute. Comes down to the fifth round, not the same fighter.
Mm.
John Jones just takes it. Imagine, definitely you could see that Jones underestimated Gustafsson. Gustafsson's taking him down. He's beating him with the hands. Everyone's like, geez, Gustafsson's going to win this fight. And John Jones just found the way. Later on, like my mixed martial arts career, looking at that, for me is one of the best examples of mixed martial arts.
Mm.
You shoot for a single, fake it to get your opponent to level change, spinning elbow to the head.
It's like a video game.
It's amazing.
That's what MMA allows you to do. There's so many tools, so many weapons that it just allows for such amazing creativity. I mean, that's what that is. It's like creative as hell.
For me, another incredible example of mixed martial arts at work is when Frank Yeager fought Gray Maynard for the third time, and he survives that first round. Remember, he's all over the place. Mm. And then it was like the third round. He kept shooting in and getting back up, shooting and getting back up. And finally, he shot in and got back up before Gray got back up and ripped him with an uppercut. And then up against the fence, just teed off on him. Gray is a wrestler, right? So Gray, it's bred into him to sprawl. And Frankie's like, let me just touch on that for a second. Shot, made him sprawl, got up, boom. Wow, that's just incredible.
And he figured it out in the fight.
Yeah. Maybe learned a little bit here and there, but you're right. He put it together. John Jones for sure learned it in the fight because he'd never fought Gustafsson before.
Mm.
You know? Amazing. I love examples of mixed martial arts. Like, okay, you know, guys like Anderson Silva and, you know, Machida or whatever, they're great mixed martial artists, but they're really striking, you know? But John Jones faking a single spinning elbow, that's mixed martial arts at its finest right there. You know what I mean?
I think so. And I think GSP is that in a way where
absolutely
he's not the best wrestler. So if you have a wrestling match, he's probably going to lose to Johnny Hendricks or something.
What do I do?
If you do a kickboxing match, he'll do okay. But when you put it all together, he's the best. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like an extreme sport. It's like, how do you train in the gym faking a single leg and doing a spinning elbow, you know? Or like Dan Henderson when he fought
Hector Lombard.
Yeah, Hector Lombard. Dan Henderson leans over to throw this head kick, and it's not the prettiest kick possible, but he almost lands it. But then he just does his back elbow and just knocks the guy out. I mean, that is mixed martial arts.
Improvisation. Like, I always tell my guys in the gym, I'm like, try and be in the cleanest at your striking, your grappling, your jiu-jitsu. Amazing. But I always tell them one of the most underrated tools that is so important in fighting is being able to improvise. Because nothing ever goes to plan.
Right.
You can have a game plan, but nothing ever goes 100% to plan. So I'm always trying to explain to my guys, you got to be able to improvise. As I feel like one of the things that I've made mistakes in fights that haven't gone my way is I get so dead set on doing one thing, and you can't just do that. You have to improvise. You have to maneuver. You have to go one way or the other way. You can't just go in and be like, I'm going to take it to the ground and submit the guy. You know, I'm going to win by knockout.
Who seems to do that well is that Brian Ortega. Yeah, he's fighting Frankie Edgar, and you're like, well, maybe you want to use your distance. Maybe you want to get him on the ground and submit him. He ends up hitting him with an elbow.
Steps in with the elbow.
Knocks him out.
Beautiful.
Unbelievable, right?
Beautiful.
And then he guillotines people. He does everything,
fantastic,
right?
Yeah.
That can't be a game plan the way he's doing it. It's so spontaneous and improvisational.
So going back to what we were talking about originally.
Yeah, the thing that I like, I'm not doing spoiler, but like we're talking about, you are almost like 18 years old. You were fighting in the UFC so soon after that. Like you're like a karate guy thinking about MMA.
Yeah, so to go back on what we were talking about there, yeah, so I'm starting to get away from karate. I'm looking at UFC as something that I feel like will help me prove to myself that I can do this thing. I had moved out, so this part of Dublin that I told you that I had been living where I got bullied, my family had moved out from there further into the countryside area called Kildare, which is the neighboring county. Just southwest of Dublin. It's still only like an hour and a half to the coast, right? It's not really countryside, but it is. It's a lot more countryside than Dublin. In fact, if you live in Ireland and you're from Dublin, everything outside of Dublin is countryside, right? It's basically like, you know, if you live in Boston, everything that's not in Boston, you're a hick, right? So we moved out there and I was still going back and forth to Dublin. I'm still doing all my training. I was starting to get away from sport karate, get more into jiu-jitsu, or at least watching it. This town that I moved out to, Newbridge, where my family moved out to, there was a group of guys, small group of guys, I found out through like hearsay in the town, that were doing jiu-jitsu Sunday mornings in this little hall in the town. And I was like, I'm just going to show up. I got to learn this stuff. So I show up and talk to the guys. They're all wearing Hicks and Gracie gis. Turns out these guys, right? Back then, they had just got in contact with Hickson, and Hickson invited these guys out to his house, and they were rolling with Hickson Gracie in his own freaking garage, and they'd done it multiple times, because I remember asking them, I was like, who's Hickson Gracie, you know, when I first got into it, and they were explaining stuff to me, and they'd show me pictures, they'd been out there, and he stayed in touch with them, and they would go out every so often, and then we had this random other Irish guy, who was a purple belt under Hoyler. Right, he started training with us. This really heavy set guy. I swear to God, man, he looked like Kung Fu Panda, but he was one of the best guys. He was incredibly technical, right? Lewis is his name. By the way, Mick Aldridge is the guy who ran this little group. Mick, great guy. But they've been going back and forth to Hickson, so I'm like, wow, I'm actually training with guys who actually are training with the guys who are in the UFC, and my mind was just blown, right? I was like, oh, this is amazing. So I'm starting to train with these guys. I'm slowly getting out of sport karate. Myself and McGregor had been friends at the time through high school, and he and I are starting to go back and forth. Connor couldn't make it to my sport karate sessions, and of course I'm starting to get away from it because he lived in a different part of Dublin, so he started going and taking up boxing lessons, and then we'd get together and I'd be like, this is what I'm learning from these jiu-jitsu guys, and he's like, this is what I'm learning from these boxing guys. We both kind of already sort of had a little bit of, well, I had a lot of sport karate experience, and he had a little bit from what I had shown him and what he learned from the few sessions that we had done together. So and then I bring him to these guys and we're starting to do a little bit of jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, did you know him through, because you were both interested in martial arts, or you knew him separately?
No, I knew Connor because literally...
Like before you even...
in high school. Oh, yeah. So like he came into my high school I'd say you call it in our junior year. He came in because his family had moved out from the inner city, like I told you. Yeah. Inner city, moved out to Lucan. You know, he came in our junior year. And I just remember turning around and seeing some big old meldy head sitting in the classroom. And I was like, who is that? And it was obviously McGregor. He was deadly serious, just sitting there. Very hostile individual. Didn't really want to talk to anybody. You know, he just sat there, kind of the way he does at a press conference, just like chin up, just sitting there. Because, I mean, that's kind of how it was, you know. Moving into a new school, especially in parts of Dublin and Ireland, growing up as a kid, I'm sure it's the same here. Inner city schools, it's kind of a hostile environment for a young man.
You gotta find your place. It'll take a little bit.
But anyways, I just walked right up to him. I was like, "Hey man, what's up? I'm Tom," and he wouldn't leave me alone. Then I was stuck with the guy. So I'm stuck with this inner city because I was the first to go up and break the ice with him. Right. He probably felt, "All right, this guy's okay." I had no idea that Connor himself had gone through similar experiences as I had with bullying and stuff. When it came to, you know, when he played soccer and all those things, I guess Connor just grew more of a tougher exterior to deal with it versus me. I kind of, I don't know how I dealt with it in a slightly different way, you know.
Do you love delicious high protein snacks? Do you love low sodium? Then you're going to love Skrizzly Adams Beef Jerky. My signature brand of beef jerky has the lowest sodium in the entire marketplace and completely destroys all its competitors in the taste department. Order now at SkrizzlyAdamsBeefJerky.com. That's SKRIZZLYADAMS BeefJerky.com. This is American recording artist Skrizzly Adams, and I guarantee you're going to love my meat.
Have you always wanted to make your own podcast? Or had dreams of becoming the next social media influencer? Don't let office space and equipment be what gets between you and your dreams. New studio space is now available through the Go Network. The Go Network is a multimedia broadcast company that currently hosts live radio shows and podcasts. With microphones to fit all guests, the ability to video record interviews, a stage for band performances, and an editing suite to put your audio and video content to the next level. The Go Network will provide assistance with producing, editing, sponsorship outreach, marketing, and more. You can create the podcast or web series you want with the lower price tag. Visit our studio location in Norwood or our audio suite in Canton. For more information, call us at 857-445-0424 or email us at info@gonet.com. That's info@geauxnet.com.
Tom, when I was in Tokyo with you last year, you told me a really interesting story about when you're on the bus and so forth. Do you remember the story I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Do you mind telling it today?
Yeah. So I've been into, at this point, I'm in my senior year of high school. There's two events that tie into this because it kind of, I think I told you the two events that tie in together. So I'm now training all jiu-jitsu, a little bit of sport karate, doing a little bit of boxing. Me and McGregor are doing our thing. We're friends a year and a half now at this point, so we're very good friends. You know, we've done a million things. At this point, I believe we had found John Kavanagh, trained once or twice at his gym. And you know, I'm starting to feel a little bit of slightly confident guy. So one day, I was taking the bus with my younger brother and a girl who I had a big crush on, right?
Had a crush on the girl.
I had a big crush on the girl. And it's me, her, and my brother, and we're taking the bus. Long story short, the bus was kind of busy, and these three guys, we have these double-decker buses in Dublin, right? These guys came down from the top deck, and they're standing, they're waiting to get out, and one of the guys is, like, looking at me, and I'm sitting there with my brother and this girl, mind their own business, and one of the guys said something to me. So I said something back to him, and then next thing you know, all three of them are in my face, and in my mind, I'm like, shit, I'm here with my brother and this girl. Why did I just do that? I should have just ignored them, you know? So anyways, we're going back and forth, and then the bus stops. In my mind, I'm just thinking, just make sure nothing happens to your brother and the girl, whatever. The rest of the bus was kind of uncomfortable with the exchanges that were going on, you know? It's kind of my fault. I'm the one who kind of looked at the guy. I was like, what the fuck are you looking at? Whatever. Shouldn't have said anything. Anyways, they all get off the bus. I kind of relax for a second, and then out of nowhere, a fist comes around the bus and nails me right in the face. And then the guy jumps off the bus and they're banging on the window as the bus is driving off, flipping me off. Mm. And I'm sitting there holding my nose. I have a bloody nose. I'm looking at the girl who I have a crush on. Then my brother, I'm like, what just happened to me right now? I'm like, it felt like my younger days where I was helpless as a kid. You know, I felt like I just got bullied right in front of the girl who I have a crush on. And my brother, like of all people, my younger brother, I'm supposed to be the big brother here, you know?
Right. You were tougher at this point. You had been training.
I feel like sort of put this you should back not be in, happening like, to me right now. I just got hit again. Yeah, this shouldn't be happening to me right now. I'm at a different point in my life. So I'm so bullshit. So Anyway, so long story short, that girl, God bless, she's a bit weird. But anyway, she went and told everybody. Tom got his ass kicked on the bus. Tom got whipped on the bus.
Not only did you lose any chance with her, she was trying to ruin your chances with anybody else at the same time.
Honestly, I never had a chance with her. Not because of me, but because of her, because she's kind of weird, whatever. But yes, yeah. In that sense.
So this is insult to injury. So it's not bad enough that you get cracked with this thing on the bus and a bloody nose. Now, a second insult to you.
Now everyone knows. So Tom, yeah. The big tough guy. I'm always a nice guy, by the way. I've always been a nice guy. That's the difference.
So you weren't bullying anybody.
I would never, because I always look at myself that, I know it sounds funny. You know, that's, again, we talk about comics this whole show. You know that Spider-Man saying, with great power comes great responsibility? Oh, yeah. I truly do believe that when you're in a position, whether it be of authority, of a certain social status, popularity, if you're a big sports guy, and especially more than anything, if you're a fighter and you're a popular fighter, and kids see that, it's a very primitive thing. It's almost like looking at the old king who's like the king of all the other guys. He's just the leader, you know. You have to be able to step down. That's one thing I think was great about Muhammad Ali. He was great with kids. Mm. He may have been bad to women or other things, but he was unbelievable with kids. You know, such a big, tough guy, king of the world, and he'd always come right down to a kid's level and like, you know, look at, which I think is so important. Anyway, so I was always a nice guy, nice, humble guy. So everyone wasn't like, you know, oh, Tom, the tough guy, like this guy got his humble pie. None of that.
I like how, like, also how a sucker punch is sort of like, oh, you got your ass kicked. You're right. Like, I didn't even
right. Feel, but you got to remember, I had felt beat. Yeah. That punch that I got, and couple that with the actual scenario itself where I was just like, why am I doing this right now? Put myself, my brother, and this girl in a little bit of danger. So when I got hit, I felt like, yeah, I deserved that. And I felt like beat. So I didn't turn around and be like, what are you guys talking about? I got sucker punched. It wasn't in me to say that.
You thought you had failed in some capacity.
I had failed. So I was accepting everything that was brought at me.
Right.
Everyone was asking me, did that happen? I was just like, yeah. No one, like, if it was a movie and you were watching, you'd be like, just tell them it was a sucker punch. You know what I mean? Yeah. But I wasn't. I was like, yeah. So now everyone thinks I got my ass beat. Now everyone's like questioning me. And Connor, you know, he was just like, Connor's one of those guys, he's a little too intense sometimes, as we know through the Artem Lobov thing that happened in New York with the dolly and all that kind of stuff. But he turned around to me right away. He goes, let's find those guys. Let's find them right away. I was like, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, what bus stop was it? And I remember the bus stop, and I told him. He's like, right, what we're going to do is every day after school, including lunchtime, because I had a car at the time, he's like, we're going to drive around and we're going to find those dudes. And he goes, we're going to bring bars and all kinds. Like, you remember those old home dumbbell sets? It was bar,
yeah.
And you slide it on and you screw it in. Yeah. We were just taking all the weights off and taking those metal bars with us just to crack dudes with.
That'd be effective.
Very effective weapon. So anyways, we were taking these things and we're driving around. And we drove around for weeks. Couldn't find the guys, right? Weeks.
Thank God.
Right? Weeks. So long story short, my morale is way down. I'm like, this is terrible. So one day, teachers organized for the seniors and the juniors to go out to a movie during school hours, right? So we're going out. We're in.
Field trip. Like, that's what they call it here. Yeah.
So we go to the movie theater. And the teachers are obviously organizing the tickets, the movie time, and everything like that. And while we're all kind of standing around, it was the seniors and the juniors. So my school wasn't really that big, but there was at least 60 plus people between my class and the juniors, right? You know what it's like. Seniors rule the school, but the juniors also have an influence on the school as well, right? While we're all waiting around, me and Connor started flow sparring. Because this is what thing we did. We just had a flow sparring, messing, blah, blah, blah. And I bump into this guy, some random person. Again, it was like downtown Dublin, in the middle of Dublin. And I bump into this guy. And he had like some type of accent. And he must have been Eastern European or something like that. He goes, hey, what the f***? Like that. And I'm like, oh, sorry, man. I don't remember much, but all I remember, he had some scarring on his face. I don't know what it was from. He was kind of mean looking. Taller dude. He was taller than me. And I bump into him, and I'm like, oh, sorry, man. Immediately, my heart's racing. I'm like, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Because the way he looked at me, he put his bag on the ground. And he goes, no, that's not all right. Like, in this, like, thick Eastern European accent, that's not okay. And then he grabs me by the neck, like, with his right hand. Now, all the juniors and seniors are watching this, because everyone got really tense for a second when he's like, no, what the hell, including the teachers. He grabs me by the neck, And I took one step back and I just threw this massive right hook. And I just knock out right in the middle of the movie theater. He is out. Everyone's just kind of standing there, including the teachers. And then Connor runs over, stands on top of the guy. And you know the movie Friday? You know that movie? He just stands over the guy and says, like, "You just got knocked the fuck out, mother." Like standing over the guy. And I was like, "Connor, get away from him." And he runs over to me. Connor goes, "Tom, go on, start kicking him in the head now." Oh, I'm like, God. "Connor, he's out." I'm like, "Leave him alone. He's out." And he's like, "No, go on, start kicking him in the head." And at that point, the guy was starting to come to and the security came over. And they're like, "What the hell's going on over here?" And the teacher was like, "This guy just attacked one of my students. We all saw the whole thing. My student defended himself, knocked the guy out." And then the security picked the guy up and escorted him out. And then I can regain my status back, you know. I wasn't trying to be this big old badass, but I just, like, at least I was able to walk around the school.
Sweet vindication.
Yeah, sweet vindication. So there you go. That was that.
I love that story because it has so much in one little.
Well, you can feel the pain of being like that high school kid who got embarrassed in front of a girl and like.
Right. Yeah, it's classic. Yeah. It's classic. Yeah. Yeah. Now we never got though. We never saw those other guys again ever. They probably know who me and Connor are, and at this point, I can imagine, you know, after all those, especially during the height of when I was doing in Ireland, and obviously Connor and. But I don't know. Maybe they do.
It's probably his big story now, right? He's like, "I hit that guy right in the face."
Yeah.
Right?
I have no idea.
Like John would say, "Thank God you didn't find the guys," right? Like, you know, who knows what.
Well, who knows
then?
What could have happened? God forbid, you know, we could have gotten serious trouble.
Right.
We could have did something.
No good was going to come from
that.
Yeah,
it was a bad idea, right? Yeah.
Nothing. No. It wasn't going to be clean. Anyways, it would have been weird. Either we would have gotten in more trouble or ourselves potentially hurt or the other guys, you know, who knows?
So I sidetracked you a little bit. So then you got Kavanaugh's place.
Oh, yeah.
And then how old were you when you actually fought in the UFC, Tom?
I was 20.
20.
Right after high school, right?
Well, I mean, I was 20. But when Connor and I graduated high school in 2006, my birthday's in April, his is in July. So I had just turned 18. And Connor turned 18 that summer. And it was that summer that we were training. We basically got out of high school and we started training with John Kavanaugh. And it was like later that fall, we were scheduled to have our first MMA fights. John Kavanaugh, I remember we had been training with him a lot and we were doing pretty well against his fighters at the time. You know, I'd been bringing in a combination of my karate, jiu-jitsu that I've been learning from these other guys. Because you know what it's like, John, if you go to another school, the jiu-jitsu that you do is different to what somebody else does. So you might be able to do well against other dudes or, you know how it
present
goes.
Present them something new that they're not familiar
exactly.
with.
Exactly. So even though Kavanaugh's has always been traditionally a jiu-jitsu grappling school, I was still able to bring stuff in that I learned from these guys who were chilling out with Hicks and Gracie all the time, you know? And then Conor, of course, brought his unique, he always had that unique striking style. His favorite fighters were always Prince Nassim, Hamid, and Roy Jones Jr. That kind of like funky, from what I remember, that's always what he loved, that type of fighting, you know? So we were doing pretty good. So John was like, "Right, I'll get you guys your first fights," because he could tell that we were passionate about doing it. And he was like, "You guys got to make sure you commit to getting to the gym, though." And I was like, "Yeah, no problem." So we somewhat get to the gym as often as we could, you know. We were doing pretty good. And we were both supposed to fight in the same night. 2 weeks before the fight, my guy pulled out. So now Connor's fighting on the show by himself. And he's got a great story about his first fight. He shows up late. He's scared as hell, nervous as hell. Basically gets thrown into the ring and he's in the ring and he's looking around and he sees me in the crowd because I'm not fighting. I'm sitting in the crowd and he's like, "Tom's in the crowd. He's holding a beer. He's all dressed up. His hair's all done." And he's like, "I'm standing in the ring. I've got gloves on me. I'm looking at this guy across the ring wants to kill me. And I'm looking at Tom going, you're the one who got me into this. Why am I doing this right now?" You know, because I was supposed to be doing it with him that night and now he's there by himself. So anyways, he ends up knocking the guy out and like, a minute, 10 seconds or something like that. It was like a standing knockout, you know? And then we probably didn't see Conor for it. He didn't get in the cage for another year and a half, 2 years. He thought he was Superman after that one win. But he had done it, you know? I had my first fight then a couple, maybe like a month or two after that. And then we didn't fight in the same card together till another year later when we were both 19. But basically, less than 2 years after my first MMA fight, I had a fight in the UFC.
So did you just get a call? You know, was it a surprise call?
Do you remember when the UFC, when they would go to new places, they would take on the new local talent? That's used to be their thing. Now they're doing all Dana White's Contender Series, The Ultimate Fight. There's a million things. Dana White looking for a fight. There's a million things that they're doing now. But at the time, it used to be like, all right, when they went to Manchester, they took on the Manchester, whoever was there, who was like a good guy, good record. If they went to Germany, they found a guy there. I think that's how they found Dennis Seaver. Then they went to another place or another place. When they came to Ireland, they were like, right, who here can we, like, we need to put a guy on from Ireland because it's a great selling point, right? You're going to make a lot of money. You're going to have a local guy fighting. UFC, everyone knows about the, knew about the UFC by 2009. It was a big thing.
Irish fans are great fans.
Great fans. But by 2009, the UFC was still the UFC. I mean, nowadays, it's like, I'm not saying that the UFC is not hard to get into. I'm not saying that. But certainly in 2009 and previous to that, it was your Matt Hughes, BJ Penn, Shogun.
Yeah, there are fewer shows. It was a more rare situation. Yeah,
Randy Couture. It's like those big, huge, you know, legendary. So I was fighting on the same card as Dan Henderson, Shogun. Like, in fact, when I was doing the press conference, I was sitting next to Shogun, Rich Franklin, Dan Henderson.
You're a 20-year-old kid.
I'm like, what the hell's going on here? These legends, you know? When they came to Ireland, you know, they obviously must have been like, right, who do we put on now? And it just so happened that when I, after I'd had my first fight, I tried to compete as often as I could. Wasn't always successful, like getting fights because of, I suffered, after my first pro fight, I suffered a broken hand. So that set me out for like 8 months the first time. And then I had my second and third pro fight within a week of each other. And I was supposed to have my next one 2 weeks after that. Like, I'll never forget, March 1st and March 8th of 2008 were my second and third pro fights, like a week from each other. And they're both, I won both first round stoppages, but I broke my hand in the second one for the second time. Like, my metacarpal was broke. So then I was out again. And then I didn't fight again until September. And then I won that. And I was supposed to fight again that November. And that fight fell through, and then I fought January, which was January 2009, which is the UFC. I wanted to have at least another 10 fights before that, but the way my injuries and a couple of things got in the way, I'd only had, well, I think I was 4-0 going into that fight in the UFC. So basically, when they wanted to see who to put on, it just so happened at the time that the fights that I had had were very well documented. You know, one of my best friends at the time, Tommy Lakes, he was a photographer and a videographer, so he was taking photos and filming all my fights when he went to them. So they could see me. They could see me.
See
they
how
could,
you move and
they,
so forth.
Yeah, they could see everything. And there was talk about me. And I was like John Kavanagh said in his book, I was the guy at the time. Right. I mean, I was definitely the most documented, but also for my division, what I could offer. So then they were like, all right, this is the guy. And then, of course, John turned around to me. He's like, I responded to the UFC. I guess they had put out a thing looking for fighters. And he goes, I responded to it, and you're the guy. And I was like, what? And it was bizarre, yeah. So less than 2 years after my first MMA fight, it was UFC, basically.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, like the O2 Arena, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like it was,
wow.
2009. That was pretty bizarre. And yeah, like I said, it's something that I can take with me and I can do. I mean, it wasn't the best outcome that I wanted. You know, certainly taught me a lot about things when it comes to the fight game. And it forced me to want to be more prepared after that. And I just learned from
now
it.
You're a coach. Tell us what you're doing now, Tom. Where are you working out of?
So right now, I'm coaching. I'm running the MMA program over at Trifecta MMA. Mm-hmm. Trifecta MMA is owned by Master Kwan, as I call him, Kenny Kwan.
Yep.
Great man. He runs
in Quincy.
In Quincy, yep. Massachusetts. Yeah, he runs a great program over there. Basically, he runs a lot of CrossFit and a martial arts program. And it's a very unique gym in the sense that you can come in, you can sign up to a CrossFit and get amazing CrossFit coaching, or you can sign up to a martial arts membership and, of course, take advantage of my program. The jiu-jitsu program is run by Robson Rodriguez, or he's known as Robson Mau Mau from Mau Mau BJJ Academy, and he, you know, he's part of GF team. And then, of course, the Thai program, the Muay Thai program, is run by Kenny Kwan himself and Coach James Cronin. They do run an amazing thing over there. But over there right now, I'm running the MMA program, and we have a lot of good fighters coming out of there. You know, we've had some good success, and, you know, I'm trying to just take all the good and the bad that's happened to me in my careers and give it to my guys. Like, so I've had ups and I've had a lot of downs, but I feel like as a coach, it's very important to focus on your downs, right?
Well, Tom, you know, I'd like to acknowledge you. I think you are an amazing coach from what
I've seen. I
appreciate
that.
And I have so much respect for your coaching. And I think you're right. I think your downs make you so much of a better coach. Mm. You know the pitfalls, the dangers mm-hmm. that are out there. And I've seen the way you coach Tyler with me, and it's so impressive. I mean, you have the technical skills, but you also bring sort of an intelligence and a sensitivity to the situation mm. where you see the guy as a fighter and you see the guy as a human beyond the fighter. Mm. And I think that's so important, so effective.
I appreciate yeah. that. I try and just have an honest outlook. I feel like it's important. I notice when you're trying to coach somebody, you have to have an honest outlook on things.
You have to be realistic in a sense.
Honest and realistic, mm. you know. You have to be able to know what's what and approach training that way too. Like you alluded to Bruce Lee earlier on, hacking things away. Mm. I mean, a famous quote by Bruce Lee is, it's not a daily increase, it's a daily decrease. Mm. Hack away at the unessentials. Mm. So keeping it real, essentially, right? Just keeping it real is one of the big things I think is important to be able to do as a coach. But no, I appreciate that. Yeah, I try and just keep, like, I try and take my downs and I use that as much as I can mm. to my fighters. Like, I'll tell some of my fighters, for example, like, you know, don't go in, you know, who did I say to my student, Mike Kimball, who's fighting for Bellator October 12th. He came off a spectacular debut for Bellator mm. and he's just like on the rise now. He's got a great personality and he is an absolute killer of a martial artist. He can do everything. I always tell him, I'm like, Mike, don't make some of the mistakes that I make. You're not going in here to compete. You're going in here to fucking go to war. You're going in here. Whatever about sportsmanship after, you know, cool. But I'm like, you got to treat this like you are going for it. You know what I mean? Because I've made the mistakes of saying, you know, I got so nervous and I'm like, I'm downplaying my emotions, right? Mm. I'm like telling myself, all right, whatever. Come on, let's just do this. No, let's not just do this. Let's cry. Let's get all teared up. Let's get fired up. This is a fight. You're in a cage for crying out loud. You're fighting somebody. So that's just one example that I can think of on the top of my mind because I've lost fights.
That's being honest too.
I'm being honest. Exactly. Again, alluding to that point, being honest. I've lost fights. You know, I've had these fights where I didn't perform my best because I didn't treat it the right way. Mm. And I can take that, acknowledge it. Like you said, being honest. And then tell my student, don't make the same mistake I did. Because I think a very big thing that you can tell somebody is not necessarily like, hey, I did X, Y, and Z, and I accomplished this. Or there's your evidence.
Yeah.
Versus, I made these mistakes. Mm. Don't make those. Because, again, like you said, being honest, being truthful, this is what can happen. And you should be aware of that. And I think that can really help a fighter a lot. Versus just, I won this way and I won that way. You know, so combining successes, ups and downs, I feel like has helped me a lot when it comes to conveying to my fighters how I would like them to, compete.
We got to wrap it up. We have to have you back, Tom. That was amazing. I feel like there's so much more.
There's so much more to do. We just barely got up to 20 years old.
Yeah.
But if folks want to reach you, they can reach you, I'm sure, on Instagram, Facebook, and everything.
If anybody wants to, you know, certainly you can follow me. I'm mostly active on my Instagram, that's the way to go now. My handle on Instagram is @TeamEganMMA. It's the same on Twitter if you want to follow me on Twitter. I'm not a big Twitter guy, but you might catch me on there, @TeamEganMMA. And, of course, you can just search me on Facebook as Tom Egan. And if you ever want to get in touch, I'm always open to answering and responding to messages. I do it all the time. And if anybody ever wants to come down to Trifecta MMA, it's in Quincy, Massachusetts. It's right near Quincy Center. So you can always look us up and come by.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, John.
All right.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Talk to you guys next week.
Thanks, guys.